This is Chatter on Books because everyone should have a podcast. And here's your host, Victoria, or as we like to call her, Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. In just a little bit, we will be talking lots with Erica Wright. She's a Chatter on Books alum, which always makes me happy. And she's back with a wonderful, addictive, fascinating book called Snake, which, no surprise, is about snakes. It's fabulous. And I have to ask Erica about who designed the cover because it's beautiful. Got some adoring email for David that I have to read. And speaking of alums, we're very happy to have back with us Ed Amar. Ed, you have to tell me how to pronounce your pseudonym, E.A.
Oh, Bars.
It is Bars. Okay.
Yeah.
Why do you have a pseudonym, and why is your pseudonym Bars?
There are a couple of reasons. When I wrote The Unrepentant, mm-hmm. I wrote it under E.A. Amar, and the reaction was nice, but it was also a little bit of so you write really violent stuff, and I didn't kind of want that to be what I was known for if I became known for anything. It was a fairly graphic book, and a lot of that came from the research I did in human trafficking, and a lot of that, honestly, I held back from what I actually read and the people I talked with. But I wanted, with They're Gone, the new book out in November, I wanted something that was, you know, more commercial, less graphic, still my book, something that had a different sense to it.
There
so I went with that, and I picked Bars because I wanted something vaguely ethnic, like myself.
There you go. Okay, so I'm holding up, for people who can't see it on the podcast, a lovely coaster that Ed sent me for the new book, They're Gone, which is very sultry and mysterious and scary looking. What can you tell us about the book without giving too much away? And we, of course, will have you back if, you know, when it comes out.
Oh, sure. Two women from very different paths. One's a Northern Virginia housewife. The other is a Baltimore bartender. Discover their husbands are both killed the same way on the same night. And the search for what happens brings them together and makes them the next targets.
Awesome. Awesome.
Thank you.
What is happening to things like DC Noir Bar? For those who remember, Ed is very big on supporting the crime thriller genre, especially in the DMV. And I know you did some virtual DC Noir Bars, but how's that going?
I'm not really that much into supporting writers. It's just if I don't, then I have to spend a lot of time with my family and raising a kid.
Why do you think I do the show?
Wow, it's like, yeah. Why do you think I asked to come back on? No, that's not it. We moved it virtually, and it's been going. I was doing it at a pretty steady clip, and then we went monthly. But I'm actually going to. We have them scheduled for November and December, and after that, I really want to switch it up. I collaborate with a musician, jazz singer named Sarah Jones, and I think what we want to do is do something that after. If the pandemic ends, something that could translate to a live experience. And I want to do something where she and I would co-host it, and we'd have on fewer writers and a couple of more musicians and make it a tight hour show.
Very, very nice. Mm-hmm. And you, I got a great package in the mail a few weeks ago as part of the promotion for They're Gone, my lovely coaster, a framed picture from the book, and a drink put together by our celebrity mixologist, Chantal. And I can't remember the drink. Do you remember it, Ed?
It was something like runner stay and fight or runner fight or some fight or flee.
Fight or flight. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it was great. And I asked Chantal to develop a drink for the show, and I'm going to unveil it in a couple of weeks. It will take 16 of us to put this thing together. It's so complicated. Okay, let's see. Let me do my handwritten note first, then we'll do David's email. So, as everybody on the show knows, I love handwritten notes, especially when they've got nice handwriting, like Kathleen Barber. Thanks so much for inviting me back on Chatter on Books. It was great to chat with you and David, and a special treat for me to Zoom meet Barbara Kingsolver, whom I so admire. Chatter is always such a fun podcast, and I appreciate you thinking of me. Best, Kathleen Barber. Very nicely written. Kathleen will always be invited. Anybody who sends handwritten notes. David, are you ready?
I'm always ready, Tor.
Okay, here we go. Hi, Chatter. Thanks for the show. Most importantly, thanks for not making me feel guilty for not having read Moby Dick. That makes me so happy. If nothing else with the show, I accomplish people not reading Moby Dick, I will feel it was a success. My questions are for David and a little off topic. One of my pandemic goals is, no, not to bake the perfect sourdough bread, but to become smarter about sports, a passion of my partner's, and an area in which I know nothing. Should I subscribe to The Athletic? And if I only followed a few sports journalists in social media, which ones would I follow? Thinking major sports here, football, basketball, baseball, etc. No cricket commentary, thanks. That's so awesome.
Wow.
So, David, talk about The Athletic, which we don't talk about enough.
Well, first of all, of course you should subscribe to The Athletic. Yes. You could be our millionth and first subscriber to The Athletic since we're now at a million.
Can we stop there for a second? That's a lot. And Ed, you can jump in because you understand these things as well. For any entity, a million is a lot, especially in times like these, right?
Yes. Yes. For, especially given that there were no sports for 3 months in this country and around the world, there were essentially no sports. It was amazing. Our subscribers have been incredible. I would definitely subscribe. And the great thing about The Athletic, as I tell people who do subscribe, is you can make it whatever you want. You can be as deep into the weeds in advanced numbers, statistics, and things. If you want to do that, there are people in every one of the sports, the major sports, that do that for those sports. Or if you just want to be, a more traditional, I'll say, fan and just read stories, great stories about whatever team you like, and you customize it to whatever team you like or whatever league you like or whatever sport you like, you can do that. That's the great thing about the website, is that we cater to everyone.
So, and as my daughter Devin likes to say, the Phantom daughter likes to say, anybody can give you the scores. She goes, you read The Athletic. If it's something you're interested in, you read The Athletic and there's a great backstory or there's context that you're not going to get somewhere else.
Well, you can read about things that, I dare say, I don't think other publications write a lot about, as far as individual writers or reporters, I don't know. That's all a matter of individual taste. Some people love Peter King, for example, who covers the NFL still, and has a very, very large following. If you're talking about baseball, Kenny Rosenthal is a great writer and a great reporter. But there's so many people. It's hard to kind of break them down.
If you, David Aldridge, could only have one to follow, who would it be?
Wow. One sports person to follow?
Yep.
Gosh, that is a good question, Tori. I'm not sure I have a good answer because you could go in so many directions.
Yeah.
For example, like LeBron's got, 32 million followers on Twitter, something like that.
God.
Something insane like that. So
the Ken Follett of.
Exactly. So, you could go in so many directions. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard for me to say. I like a lot of different things about sports, but I kind of have a foot outside of it too. So I'm not as diehard, I think. I would just say this. You could watch some ESPN. They obviously talk about sports all the time on ESPN. Read The Athletic. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. And then, kind of decide how much you want to get into whatever sport it is.
How deep you want to get. Just not cricket.
I have a question, David. So I'm a fan of the Wizards and I'm a fan of the Dolphins.
Yeah.
Would I be able to read The Athletic without feeling terrible about my choices?
No, that's the great thing. Look, I know I'm an acolyte for it, but that doesn't mean I'm wrong, right? So, that's the great thing, is that you have a lot of Wizards content and a lot of Dolphins content. And also for people who have different tastes, when there's maybe people who just like auto racing, we got that. People just like golf and tennis. We got that too. So we cover everything. The WNBA, we're very proud of the fact that we covered the WNBA. We have, last year, because of a lot of different reasons, we couldn't be quite as in depth with every team, but we have a great writer, also named Chantal, ironically enough, who covers the league. And she was in the bubble down in Bradenton for 2 months covering the league and the championship. So we cover everything, cover everything. And if you like soccer, football, that's the beautiful part, is that we literally hire 200 people to cover European soccer. So whatever team you're a fan of.
Is that right? 200?
Oh, yeah.
Holy cow.
Might be more than that. We cover just about every team that plays soccer in Europe on a, wow. on a serious basis. So, I mean, it's
okay. I should know this. Do you guys cover e-games, e-gaming?
We're getting into that space. In fact, one of our college basketball writers just did a piece for us for the DC Bureau because the Wizards esports team, because every team in the league has one, they just won the esports championship. The NBA's esports championship.
Right.
So yeah, we're getting into that space.
I love it. Anybody who's dialing into the show or whatever you do to download, get these shows and comes in halfway through is going, am I in the wrong show?
I know. I'm sorry.
No.
Please talk to the people who wrote books instead of me.
I find this fascinating. Well, no, we got a pop quiz and then we'll go to Erica and talk about this book, which I have just loved. And I told Erica,
that was really cool book.
The House of Me.
That was fun.
The big e-gamers, the really big successful e-game athletes, I don't know if that's what you call them, are making huge money.
It's a genre that I'm amazed. And I know it's not my I'm not their demographic. I get that. I'm old.
Right.
So I get it. But the fact that they sell out Madison Square Garden or Chicago Stadium or, you know, the Staples Center, you know, 20,000 people come and watch this. Millions of people watch on TV or they watch on streaming or on Twitch or something. It's amazing. Yeah. You're right. I mean, and it's a global phenomenon. I mean,
And it seems to have come up on us so fast, but if you talk to smart people 10, 12 years ago, like Brian Roberts, Ted Leonsis, they were onto it.
Ted is a true believer. He's got, you know, he put some money into that space, and his son, Zach, is running the Wizards team essentially. Yeah. And so, I mean, it's a very lucrative, and actually a lot of colleges are now offering gaming as majors because down the road that could potentially be a source of revenue in terms of varsity athletics in college.
And I may be making this up, but they can do a lot of it virtually, obviously. So the pandemic has not crushed it as much as
that's
it
right.
might have.
That's right.
Okay. This is Chatter on Sports. Thanks for joining us.
Good Lord, I'm bored, Tori. Go on with the books.
Okay, wait. We're taping this on October 19th, which happens to be a very big day in literature. So, okay, Erica, I'm going to properly introduce you in a minute, but you want to participate in the pop quiz?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, you can participate in the pop quiz. Okay, so I got three questions. We'll see who you got to yell out your answers. On this day, in 1953, this book was published in the midst of the Red Scare. It was based on a 25,000-word short story called The Fireman. What book was it?
Fahrenheit 451.
Fahrenheit 451 is what I would
say. Yes. Ed, do you have a different answer?
I don't have an answer.
Okay. Okay, that's it. Fahrenheit 451. And fascinatingly, Ray Bradbury, writing the short story upon which it was based, was casting about, didn't have a place to work and this and that, and there was some basement at UCLA or something like that, where you could use a typewriter for about 10 cents for half an hour. So he wrote the short story in about 10 days or 2 weeks because he only had so much money. But that was the short story upon which it was based. So there you go.
Amazing.
Okay. So this author was born on October 19th in 1931. And there was a famous editor, Robert Gottlieb, who said, calling him, this author, a spy writer is like calling Joseph Conrad a sea writer or Jane Austen a domestic comedy writer. Mm-hmm. So who was born on this day, a spy writer, in 1931?
John Le Carre.
Erica, guess?
That sounds right to me, yeah.
There you go. Ding, 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 ding.
Boom.
Very cool. Ed, do you like him? Ed, you're kind of a spy thriller guy.
You know, I read a couple of his books, and I never quite got into him as much. But, I mean, he's, you know, obviously a great writer. I just wasn't my particular cup of tea, but.
Okay. All right. Okay, last one. This author died on this day. In 1745, and the alternate name for one of his most famous works, travels into several remote nations of the world in four parts. And you get a bonus point. He was an author, but he also had a second profession, if you know the
Jonathan Swift.
Erica?
Jonathan Smith. Yeah, that must be Gulliver's Travels, but I don't know a second profession.
Ed?
Yeah, same. I don't know a second profession.
There you go. It was Jonathan Swift. He was a cleric. He was
really? I didn't know that.
Traveled. Had to make money somehow.
I guess so.
But there you go. So October 19th. Big day.
You crushed your quiz this week, Tor.
Crushed the quiz. I should have made it harder.
No. I like success.
Okay. Okay. Erica, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So when last we talked, author of Famous in Cedarville, you were hinting that you were writing this book about snakes, and we all kind of went, whatever. But the news we were talking about before the show. You're making a baby human, and it's about here.
That's true. Yeah, 6 more weeks.
Yay. How has it been being pregnant during a pandemic?
Well, it was very easy to keep it a secret, I'll tell you that much. So, you know, that was nice because you had this kind of added layer of privacy, which I did appreciate. And, you know, I think that it has, the only thing that's really been anxiety inducing is that you have so many medical appointments. So you're sort of kind of going into the belly of the beast several more times than you would otherwise. But
and are you actually going in for your appointments, or are you doing them via Zoom?
A couple have been telemedicine, which is nice. So,
yeah,
it's nice to go to the doctor in your pajamas.
As we were talking before the show, everybody, just keep the pants on. Come on. So your many, many roles in life, you're the poetry editor of Guernica Magazine, which is this wonderful intersection of politics and art and these kinds of things. Has the pandemic shaped or reshaped the kinds of submissions you all get or the kind of things that people are working on for the magazine?
Absolutely. And that's, you know, it's kind of true in general, because we are an art and politics magazine, that, you know, we get kind of waves of submissions about current events. But the pandemic in particular, I think, has been, I've seen more pandemic poems than I have of any other genre, you might say. The only other analogy I would say is after the 2016 election, sort of about 2 or 3 months later, we also got a wave of kind of election poems. So that is similar. But yeah, we're still getting our pandemic poems in the submissions.
And do you like any of them? What are they like?
Yeah, you know, a couple we have actually published. And, you know, I think political poems are a genre that's very difficult to get right. Obviously, I love it, or I wouldn't be the poetry editor at this journal. Yeah. But, you know, they kind of have the same sort of risks as occasional poetry. So trying to write a wedding poem, or trying to write a, you know, an inauguration poem, you know, very difficult to write with this sort of narrow lens and to stay within that lens. Part of what is exciting about poetry is that you can leap from subject to subject. You don't have to have these explanations. But when you do kind of focus in on one subject, it becomes tricky. But we've had some really fantastic submissions. And what's interesting is that it's not just in the US, of course. So we're getting submissions about the pandemic from a lot of different nations and a lot of different voices.
Is there a different trend or pattern or theme or essence to them from different parts of the world?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I find that in general, the international submissions, and this is such a broad statement, but I'm going to make it anyway, there does tend to be more of an embrace of what you might call philosophy, or just not a fear of big ideas. I think that we're living through a really exceptional time in US poetry. We have some fantastic poets, a lot of kind of younger and emerging poets. But there is kind of a cynicism that I feel like we really have here, and
you
can see it in the sharpness of the language. A lot of international submissions have, they're just kind of more willing to embrace kind of larger philosophical ideas.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. All right. Let's talk about this fabulous book, Snake. And the first thing I want to start with, and I'm going to describe this book to people who are listening to this. It's small. It's very easy to hold. It's beautiful. It's matte black and has this beautiful, I think that's a king snake on the cover, Erica?
It looks a lot like a king snake, but that's actually a Western shoveled nose snake.
That was my second guess. of course, was my second guess. But it's beautiful. And I told Erica the other day, we were trading emails, I moved this book around to different rooms in my house because it's so pretty. You just want to have it out. But it is part of this series called Object Lessons. Tell us about the series first.
I love this series and I'm so proud to be a part of it. Basically, they are there's a really wide range, and authors are given a lot of flexibility with how they approach their chosen subject. But basically, they are the author chooses a subject. We've got dust, refrigerators, potato, the high heel, and they look at it from a variety of different angles. So, what's the cultural significance? What's the history of this object? Is there sort of any kind of medical or political connotations to it? So it's sort of, I always think of it as sort of taking a lens and doing a, you know, a 360 view, just kind of going around a particular subject.
Cell tower, cigarette lighter, ocean, password. I had no idea the series existed. And as we're getting closer and closer to the holiday season, I tell everybody, of course, when Ed's book comes out, they're gone by that, by Erica's book, Snake. But these are great gifts for people who aren't big time hardcore book readers. So somebody who loves golf, get golf. somebody who's a germaphobe and hates dust, get them the one on dust, I'm guessing, which I haven't read, but they're absolutely beautiful. So you're well known in literary circles. They come to you and say, we want you to write something. How did you pick snakes?
Well, I came to them. And in fact, I wanted to write this book so badly. And I usually don't get my hopes up about anything having to do with publishing because it's just a, you're setting yourself up for heartbreak. Yeah. But I, as soon as I sent the proposal in, I could not stop checking my email. I just wanted to write this book. I attended the Rattlesnake and Wildlife Festival in Claxton, Georgia.
Of course.
In about 2013. And I wrote an essay about it. And I kind of thought that maybe I had all my snake writing out of my system. And then slowly this little folder I had on my computer of snake research and interesting snake stories just kept growing and growing. And I really just wanted to write. I wanted to write about snakes. And I particularly wanted to be part of this very cool series.
Yeah. So one of the things I read as a child, you were kind of afraid of snakes and you were afraid of the silence of them. Did you think they were going to sneak up on you? What was the fear?
Oh, they did sneak up. Sneaky little danger noodles. Absolutely. I grew up in a very small town of 500 people in rural Tennessee. So there are probably, no, there are definitely more snakes than people there. And, you know, you're out playing in the yard and there's a chicken snake that's hanging out watching you run through sprinklers. Or, you know, we had a few incidents where snakes were actually in the house. And I've more or less gotten over my phobia of snakes, but I still think that they should stay outdoors. So if I could have a conversation with these critters, I would encourage them to stay in their own environments. So yeah, no, but I do think that their silence is a part of the fear that we have of them. One of the questions I was asking in the book is, why is this such a widely held phobia? In fact, it's the number one phobia in the U.S. above public speaking. And even though more people actually die from spider bites each year.
Yeah.
So I, you know, was sort of exploring this question of fear and where it comes from. Some of it might be innate, which is interesting. So if infants are shown photographs, a variety of photographs, when they see a photograph of a snake, their pupils will dilate. So there's this possibility that it's some sort of innate kind of sense of danger. But I also think that they're such a unique creature in that they move without legs and they are, except for, you know, the rattlesnake, pretty much silent. So they can sort of just be right underfoot.
And you don't know.
And you do not know.
What one of the greatest expressions I read was the a crawling contradiction. And it, the more I read this book, the more I thought, okay, in the dictionary under contradiction, there ought to be a picture of a snake. Because whether it's in literary use or medical use or religious use, there's always the plus and minus, right? There's always the positive and the negative of the snakes. And the more I read this, the more I thought, I can't think of anything else like that, right?
Absolutely. And I actually can't think of anything else that holds kind of its own duality at once either. So, of course, the medical uses are so interesting because you know, a venomous snake bite is, of course, very dangerous. But our antidote, antivenin, we get entirely from snakes. There's no synthetic version currently. Hopefully one will be developed soon because that'll save a lot of lives. But you have to have the specific species in order to create the antivenin. So you can't
Can we just a public we stop there for a minute because I wander around in the hills of Virginia. So you not only have to know what kind of snake bit you, you have to be able to get to a place that has that particular antivenin.
Yes,
that is for a friend. Okay.
That is correct. That is correct. And before I elaborate, I will say that in almost all cases of death from snake bites in the US, which is only about 7 per year, someone is trying to kill that snake. So if you leave them alone, they will leave you alone.
Yeah. I mean,
so that should comfort people. But yes, absolutely. So if you are bitten by a timber rattlesnake, you need timber rattlesnake antivenin, not Mojave rattlesnake. You need the actual species that has bitten you.
You need a map carried along with you. And religion, positives and negatives. I mean, obviously, Adam and Eve got that, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, and in most religions, it's the same. So they have kind of negative and positive connotations. They're often seen, you know, as sort of wily and conniving, these sort of personifications of the snake, but they're also seen as a symbol of resurrection because they shed their skins and they have this kind of a new life. So you see that kind of symbolism come up repeatedly in all sorts of different areas. So again, you know, medicine, we have the Rod of Aeschylus that we is on hospitals and ambulances. Sure. But then of course they can be deadly.
This is just so fabulous. There was so much material in this book, and I keep describing to people just this wonderful small book, and I love carrying it around, but there was so much material. There was your relative Milton, who almost died from a snake bite. There are the beauty pageant contestants who would dip their hands in the snake blood. How did you decide what got to stay in this wonderful book and what you threw out? How did you curate all this information?
That was incredibly difficult. And in fact, I have a notebook full of kind of leftover research. And when I flip through it, I'm so kind of, there's still so many fun anecdotes. Maybe I should write a sequel. Maybe I should
pitch absolutely Snake 2.
So yeah, it was definitely difficult to decide. I kind of took my own advice in how I think of the series, which is this idea of kind of circling around a subject. Yeah. So there's a chapter on medicine. There's a chapter on fashion, which was the most difficult one for me to write because I started at zero right. knowledge. If things didn't kind of fit into these categories I wanted to explore, unfortunately, they got left on the cutting room floor.
Okay. Talk about the chapter called A Mouse in Your Teeth. And this essentially goes to how snakes just aren't that lovable.
Right. So, I actually asked Ed this because I think you had a pet reptile of some sort, Ed, but I'm forgetting what you had. Did you have a turtle? Did you have growing up?
Yeah, I had an iguana for 10 years and now we have a turtle.
That's nice. Right. That's right.
What was the iguana's name, Ed?
Iggy.
Of course.
Very imaginative. Of course. Yeah.
Such a creative writer.
Very clever. So yeah, so I was interested in this idea of emotional attachment.
Yeah.
We become so attached to our pets. I've got a little beagle mix, Penny, who is a mess, but I wouldn't replace her for anything. And I was thinking about the idea, do snake owners become emotionally attached to their critters? And to a certain extent they do, but there's this layer of fascination that I think outshines that a little bit. So a lot of times when I was talking to snake pet owners, the first thing that they would mention is that, it's a little bit like having a natural wonder in your house, that you get to study how they move, you get to study their scales and how beautiful they are. And the language was just different than how I hear people talk about their cats and their dogs. So that was definitely interesting to me. And in that chapter in particular, I was writing about, one of the things I was writing about is snake milkers. So people who milk snakes for a living, it is incredibly lucrative. So
how much do you get paid if you're a snake milker? Come on. This is important. Pandemic, we're looking for work.
I couldn't find anyone who had kind of gone on the record about how much they make, but certain antivenoms are worth kind of $1,000 a gram. So if you have kind of a rare snake, you're making quite a bit of money. And obviously it's a high risk job. Yeah. But one of the, one of the snake milkers mentioned that, a snake won't come to you even if you have a mouse in your teeth. That's where that great phrase comes from. They're not pets. So even if you care for them, even if you feed them, they're not that interested in you.
Yeah. I don't know if it still exists, but there used to be a reptile museum or place up in Luray, Virginia, or Luray, as they call it out there. And they would always have a demo presentation about the snakes. And they always wanted to point out, to your point, that they don't bite that often. It's that saying in the last 30 or 40 years, only 8 people have died in the state of Virginia from snake bites. And 6 of them were drunk and 2 of them were using them in religious ceremonies. And you talk about this with some detail and you talk to people, they are still being used in religious ceremonies, right?
Absolutely. It's still legal in West Virginia. It's the only state where it is legal in the US. There probably are ones that are hidden in other parts of Appalachia. But in West Virginia, it's still kind of openly practiced. What I found interesting about that, frankly, it's just interesting in general, right? This idea of people practicing.
Absolutely. Like, what are they trying to accomplish in their ceremonies with the snake? What is the snake symbolizing?
Well, there's a passage in the Book of Mark. So it's New Testament, which I was actually surprised by, Jesus tells his disciples during the Last Supper or kind of in his last days that you shall go out and handle venomous snakes and drink poison and not be harmed. So it kind of hinges. I always say it hinges on that word shall. So is it a prophecy or is it a command? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And these sort of what are called signs following Pentecostal churches. So not all Pentecostal churches do this, of course, but the signs following ones, think of it as a command that they are asked to drink poison and they are asked to handle these venomous snakes as proof of their faith in God. So that is kind of the basis of the philosophy.
Awesome. All right, let me get you out with this. On the back of this beautiful book, it is Andrew Monson of the University of Arizona has a great blurb, and I won't read the whole thing. But at the end, Andrew Monson says, as it turns out, talking about snake, what we talk about when we talk about snakes is ourselves, which is a wonderful line. What did you learn about yourself when you were writing this book?
I try to be very honest about my own fear of snakes growing up and how irrational that was. And frankly, it was kind of embarrassing to admit at some point in the writing process, because I'd shifted so far into fascination, to admit that, you know, I really couldn't have cared less about something like a rattlesnake roundup, which is such a brutal event.
Yeah.
I think requires a lot of kind of inner reflection. So what do we excuse because of fear? What kind of behaviors can we excuse because of fear? I think examining that question really required me to be honest with myself while I was writing, and not to kind of hide that, even though by the end of the book, I wanted to be like, oh, I've always loved snakes. I was a herp kid, as they call them, but no, absolutely not. I, you know, could have cared less how many snakes were slaughtered. And now I think what a loss to those ecosystems. Uh-huh.
Very, very cool. Okay. We'll come back to this in Deserted Island. Ed, fascinated? You're going to have a snake in your next book? What do you think?
Oh, God, no. I live in a neighborhood that is frequented by snakes. And the neighborhood.
What kind, you know?
Big. And the neighborhood Facebook page full of photos of, well, in addition to reminding everybody not to speed, the other posts are all about snakes that they found in their houses. So I'm constantly like darting out to the car and darting back in. But you know, one thing, I love this book. As I told Erica a couple of times now,
it's fascinating. You couldn't put it down, right?
Yeah, but I was curious, you know, when you talked about like the, was it the rattlesnake rodeo where the snakes were slaughtered?
Roundup.
You know, a lot of times it seemed that there was a lot of anger. I felt that you restrained. And I didn't know if I was, you know, I can imagine that was the case. I mean, it seems like an awful thing, but was I misreading that or?
No, that's definitely true. And again, but one of the reasons I didn't want to just express anger is because, you know, I had heard of roundups before and had never really thought twice about them. So it would be really unfair of me to condemn people who are attending these events without kind of doing some self-reflection. But and also I think roundups have changed a lot historically. I don't think I talk about this in the book, but you know, they used to be kind of in you know, small towns where people were getting bitten and dying because they did not have access to antivenin. There's a famous Richard Avedon photograph from a roundup, and I don't remember the year, but maybe 50s or 60s. So there was a time when kind of people going out and sort of clearing the area of rattlesnakes probably did have some sort of, you know, practical purpose. But now they're kind of like festivals. So, you know, they kind of round them all up and they, you know, they really kind of torture the snakes before they kill them, and they're participating in all these rituals. So yeah, there's definitely some anger. You know, even with rattlesnakes, which are incredibly difficult. And as Tori mentioned, my second cousin almost died from a rattlesnake bite. He just couldn't get enough kind of antivenin pumped into his body, but he did not. He survived. But, you know, they are still part of our ecosystems. And every time that humans mess with ecosystems, it turns out badly. It's yes. kind of like a horror movie. You know, things are going to go badly. Just kind of leave the critters alone.
Jeffrey Goldblum in Jurassic Park. Everyone should just watch that once a week. And go, do not mess with Mother Nature.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
David, any childhood horror stories with snakes for you?
No,
growing up in the wilds of DC?
No. But I still have the irrational fear that, you know, you wake up at 3 a.m. and you go to the bathroom and there'll be a snake in the toilet. We all have that, right? I mean, everybody has that.
Absolutely.
I'm not like terrified of snakes. I wouldn't want to be around them for very long, but I don't have like a lifetime fear of them, I don't think, unless they're on a plane, in which case that would be very bad.
In which that case, would, very, very bad. Yeah. So Erica, it really, the book is Snake. It's part of Object Lessons, which is fabulous. Everyone should check out Snake. Everyone should check out Object Lessons. What's next, Erica? You're going to be very busy with your baby human, but what's next in the writing scene?
Well, I am kind of clawing my way through a retelling of Shakespeare's Measure for Measure set in a snake handling Pentecostal church. And I promised my agent this is the last of the snakes.
Oh, that's so great.
I'm hoping that that turns out to be true. But yeah, so it's set in Western Virginia. It's a modern kind of take on what is personally my favorite Shakespeare play.
Awesome. Okay, you have to come back and talk to us about that one.
If I finish it, absolutely.
You'll finish it. Okay, I've got a little bit of housekeeping, and then I've got Deserted Island. So housekeeping, the usual, please download us, review us if you have time, those kinds of things. We come back next week with Jess Walter. And I don't know if anybody on listening to this read Beautiful Ruins. If you hadn't, go read Beautiful Ruins. And he's going to be talking with us about a book called Cold Millions, which is fabulous. And it's very hard to describe briefly, but seldom have I read something where you look back to get a really terrific sense of where we are today. Just a really fabulous guy. So we'll be back with him. Okay, so here's Deserted Island. We'll go slightly away from snakes, but stay with phobias. So we each have to describe, Erica, if you want to stick with snakes, but I don't think they're a phobia, you can. But what is your worst fear, your worst phobia? And I will go first, since I didn't tell Ed or David I was doing this. So mine is a completely irrational fear of heights. Heights in general, bridges in particular. I cannot drive across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. I use that service where you call and somebody comes and drives your car across, which, by the way, is a fabulous service. Heights
that.
In general,
wow.
Bridges in particular, cannot do it. Just telling you about that fear and that phobia, I start to break out in a sweat. David, irrational fear or phobia?
Turbulence.
Really, in a plane?
Oh,
but that's rational because the plane could crash.
No, but that's just it. I know the plane's not, you know, there's very little chance the plane's going to crash.
Wrong.
No, that's not, no.
Let's just talk about flying. Let's just chatter on flying.
No,
big metal tube hurtling through the air.
They're very good about the planes not crashing now. They really don't crash. Something would have to go really wrong. In fact, multiple things would have to go really wrong for the plane to crash.
But
so I know in my head the plane's not going to crash, but it's still, it's the worst. It's the worst. I become a complete basket case in turbulence. I'm awful. You don't want to be near me.
Do you write notes on the back of the throw bag?
No, I'm just awful. It's just the worst. I'm terrible. I can't do it. I'm bad with it. It's awful. I'm bad.
If you know there's going to be bad weather, will you not get on a plane?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I remember.
That's big.
I remember.
That's
going,
big.
I was on a flight. I was just flying up to Connecticut because I had to go to ESPN at the time. And I got to the airport and it was 7 a.m. And, you know, because I'm phobic about weather and turbulence, I always, you know, okay, the best time to fly is in the morning because the bad weather doesn't usually come till the afternoon.
Yes.
For whatever reason. There was end of earth thunderstorms coming through DC at 7 a.m. I've never seen the sky look like that. I got my bag back. I rented a car and I drove up to Connecticut and I would do it again.
That one's so irrational. Okay, Ed.
I'm not that afraid of heights, I find, unless I'm somewhere really high. But otherwise,
seriously, when it kicks
fine.
In, but just go ahead.
Yeah. I would say my big fear, and there's a specific element of it, is balloons. I don't like balloons, people playing with them. The thing that really gets me is when babies in particular have balloons and they're dragging their fingers on them, you know, that what sound, and it's going to pop and their heads, it's going to get in their eye. I freak out. If I'm at a kid's party and that's happening, you'll see me standing in the corner like the Blair Witch Project, like facing it and shivering. Like, I don't want to see this happen. I don't want to see this happen.
Okay, you have to put that in one of your books. Erica, do you have any others?
I actually have a lot of irrational fears. So I was just kind of going through the list in my head of what's the most ridiculous one.
I have a fear of fears.
Fear of fears. A recent one in the past couple of years, because I heard this urban legend about it, is someone living in the crawl space of your home. I don't know if anyone's heard this particular story. Oh. Yeah, I think it actually it has happened maybe once or twice, but people sort of living in the kind of attic space and then kind of getting wedging their ways into the walls and emerging.
Wow.
To steal
Never
your groceries
and stuff. I am writing it down.
So I yeah so sometimes if I you know I'll just kind of make sure I check my heat and air vents to make sure there's no eyes looking at me.
That's fabulous. All right, everybody, thank you so much. Erica, thank you for joining us. Come back with what sounds like a terrific next book. Ed, Amar, thank you for joining us. Come back when you've got their gone out and we'll make the cocktail. You know, if we could do it in person, we'll have Chantal come and make the cocktail. If not, we'll just make it ourselves and do a really bad job of it. David, thank you very yes. much, my friend. Claude, for doing everything important. Everybody, thanks for listening. Come back next week with Jess Walter. And in the meantime, wash your hands and wear a mask.